I speak to you in the name of the God who gives living water. Amen. March 12th, 1975, dawned cold and clear in Neshota, Wisconsin. The community of Neshota House Seminary made their way to the refectory as usual after morning prayer, anticipating the events later that day. Bishop James Duncan of Miami awoke, none too happy to see the temperature at 4 below zero. The foot of snow on the ground did not improve his mood. But Bishop Duncan was far from home that day to ordain me a priest in the church. 5 years before that, I had been ordained in the United Methodist Church, and my journey through the wilderness had brought me to this day, preparing to be made a priest. I had served 2 years as pastor of a lovely Methodist church in Dade County, realizing in those 2 years that I was thirsty for a fuller church community. After extensive discernment, conversations with Bishop Duncan, with my own Methodist bishop, colleagues and friends of many sorts, I relinquished my orders at the Methodist annual conference, loaded up the U-Haul truck, towing our Dodge Dart behind us, and together with my wife and first son, we journeyed north to spend a year at Neshota House Seminary, being marinated in Anglicanism, reading Anglican theology, teaching preaching, serving as deacon in the daily mass for most of a year, advising some of the seminary students, and finally arriving at the Feast of Gregory the Great, March 12th, ready for the hands of the bishop. The night before my ordination, I dreamed about the event. In my dream, we had a lovely liturgy filled with songs and chants and incense and hymns and sermons. I knelt before the bishop and he laid his hands on my head, asking God to make me a priest in the Church of God. When the prayer was over, the bishop lifted his hands from my head, and as I took his hands to stand, I noticed that his hands were bloody. I've never been able to adequately interpret that dream. But I'm happy to say the ordination went well, with no bloody hands, but plenty of joy and a sense of thirst filled. Last Thursday was the 45th anniversary of my ordination as a priest. Actually, I didn't do anything special. We had our Lenten program, and then I drove home. I looked at a few pictures. Remember when I was young, with a full head of hair, beard, a mustache, and I offered prayers of thanksgiving for these many years of my priesthood. I felt great delight that after so many years, God brought me together with you. During these 45 years, I have dealt with many challenges, difficulties in the church, challenges in our world around us, like the introduction of the new prayer book, now 45 years old. I was present for the reception in our church of the remarkable gifts of women in the priesthood and episcopate, a change not without turmoil, if you remember. I was seated on the floor of the General Convention as a deputy when Gene Robinson's election as Bishop of New Hampshire was approved, with much ensuing turmoil, as you may remember. I was driving back to St. Paul's Cathedral on September 11, 2001, from a meeting at a downtown bank, trying to get funding for a new ministry we were starting when I heard that planes had struck the World Trade Center. I never imagined on March 12, 1975, that I would need to shepherd a cathedral community and a city through those dark days. Now we are facing this threat of the coronavirus. I've learned more about viruses in the past week than I ever knew. In the rapidly changing landscape of public health planning, prevention, caution, and mitigation, we're trying to shepherd a new generation of a church community with care, responsibility, and hope. Nothing in my training to be a priest actually helps here. We did not have a course in disaster mitigation at seminary, nor do we have any instruction on how to scrub a church full of free of viruses. But we are here, and together with our brothers and sisters around the world, we are asked to respond to this strange threat, which is not a moral punishment, just one of those things that hover around in the natural world, erupting every so often. I'm not an epidemiologist, and I have to trust those who understand these things or are trying to understand the behavior of this virus and our behavior in the face of it. But I've been struck by a few things in our national life, and without trying to minimize the significance of this public health risk, let me say this. I keep hearing that this person or that person is infected. Basketball players, governors, mayors, celebrities, residents of nursing homes, children in school, always it's said they are infected. Now, while that's true, let us be judicious in that term, infected. Long ago, in the second decade of my priesthood, I served as rector of St. Michael's Parish in Litchfield, Connecticut. Two months after I began my ministry there, 2 months after I started at St. Michael's, I received a call from the Northwest Connecticut AIDS Project. This was a group of family and friends of persons suffering from AIDS. This was also 1985, and panic and fear ruled the day. This group wanted to meet in our parish hall as a support group to talk. It took 2 vestry meetings to approve their request. And as a consequence of allowing these people to meet in our parish hall, 3 families left the parish, the sexton resigned, and I had to deal with dynamics I never imagined on March 12, 1975. Infected is a normal clinical term, but it is also capable of becoming a free-ranging fear-monger, infected. Let us prevent infections, but not demonize those who are infected. Let us try to contain infections, but not let nursing home residents die alone without husbands or wives or families present. Let us provide the means to contain the spread of the virus without blaming anybody, without politicizing an illness, and let us try to avoid panic. As serious as this virus is, it is not the Black Death, which killed about a third of Europe's people with no regard for age, station, or wealth. We are hyper-connected in our world. We buy telephones whose parts are made in China. We drink wine made in France. We depend on medicines and food and supplies from all over the world. That is good news. But the little annoying virus also spreads far and wide. Our gospel today tells the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman meeting at Jacob's well. Fortunately, there was no ban on gatherings at the well that day. Fortunately, there was no ban on drinking water from that well. Fortunately, neither Jesus nor the woman considered the other unapproachable, so alien they could not even talk. And this was a Jewish man and a Samaritan woman. And the Jews and Samaritans didn't get along on the best of days. But because they came close and spoke to each other, Jesus quenched his thirst, and the woman received blessing beyond her expectations. On that cold day in March 1975, there was nothing in my ordination that prepared me for figuring out how to shepherd a congregation during such a public health crisis. The words were beautiful. The liturgy was splendid. I felt God was with me. But here we are today. I'm still a priest, and we now have to figure out how to live together as we wait for the pestilence to pass. I don't have magic answers. I sent an email to all of you yesterday. If you haven't checked your email, it's there, should be there, about the practicalities of the current time. As I said in the email, the common cup is suspended for now. We will not pass the offering plates, but they're right here, so please put your offering in the plates as you come to receive communion. During the peace, just smile and nod, and know that we are giving, air kisses and air hugs. And know that Jesus is with us, even so. Our breakfast and anticipated Lenten picnic are canceled for now. I will keep in touch with the bishop's office, make the best pastoral decisions for our well-being. I close with words sent to me by one of our own parish members. Whatever our concern, whatever our fear, whatever adjustments we make in life, let us take these words to heart. May we who are merely inconvenienced remember those whose lives are at stake. May we who have no risk factors remember those most vulnerable. May we who have the luxury of working from home remember those who must choose between preserving their health or making their rent. May we who have the flexibility to care for our children when their schools close remember those who have no options. May we who have to cancel our trips remember those who have no safe place to go. May we who are losing our margin money in the turmoil of the market remember those who have no margin at all. May we who settle in for a quarantine at home remember those who have no home. As fear grips our country, let us choose love. During this time when we cannot physically wrap our arms around each other, let us find ways to be the loving embrace of God to our neighbors. Amen.